జరుగుతుంది. ఆంధ్రప్రదేశ్ సివిల్ బడ్జెట్ కమిటీ అండ్ ఏపీపీఎస్సీ అన్ ఆర్గనైజేషన్ విత్ ఇన్ ఇట్ మేనిఫెస్టో ఇన్ ఇట్స్ ఎయిమ్స్ అండ్ ఆబ్జెక్ట్ హ్యాస్ ఇంక్లూడెడ్ యాజ్ వన్ ఆఫ్ ది మేజర్ ఏరియాస్ ఆఫ్ యాక్టివిటీ అపోజిషన్ టు క్యాస్ట్ డామినేషన్ యాజ్ నాట్ జస్ట్ డూయింగ్ ఫ్యాక్ట్ ఫైండింగ్ వెన్ దళిత్స్ ఆర్ అసాల్టెడ్ బై అప్పర్ క్యాస్ట్ పర్సన్స్ ఆర్ ట్రై టు గెట్ కేసెస్ ఫైల్డ్ అండ్ ఫోన్ టేకింగ్ అప్ ది ఇష్యూ ఆఫ్ క్యాస్ట్ ఇట్సెల్ఫ్ యాజ్ సివిల్ రైట్స్ పర్సన్ విత్ టేక్స్ వెల్ బియాండ్ మియర్లీ అపోజింగ్ అట్రాసిటీస్ ఆన్ దళిత్స్. Now this understanding is not something that APCSC had from the beginning. Our organization took form in 1973 and in our initial manifesto our framework did not really include either caste or patriarchy or secularism such notions as part of our concern. It was only in the course of activity, in the course of experience, especially in the course of reacting to and responding to situations as well as questions which come up from society when you are talking of civil rights, that we gradually expanded our activity and understanding. And it was 18 years after the organization was born in 1991 that in our general body we discussed and amended our constitution and included one clause that we will regard caste both as a social system and as a culture, as by itself and in itself a civil rights problem. That is, the very existence of caste as a system and as a culture is a denial of democratic rights and civil rights. And we will take it into our domain of function. That is, whatever we have been doing, whatever framework of activity we have, when we talk of state violence, when we talk of undemocratic legislation like TADA or NSA, when we talk of industrial pollution and so on. Within that framework and with those aims, we will also try to function towards the ultimate goal of annihilation of caste. I think when we try to elucidate, try to give this content, I will do this both from the point of view of the concrete experience of APCSC and from the more general viewpoint. There is no point in merely discussing this abstractly. In particular, why is it that a large number of civil rights organizations in India even today do not regard caste as a civil rights issue? Many of them are very uncomfortable when we say that APCSC is taking up, as far as investigating atrocities on Dalits is concerned, I think most people are taking it up as an activity. But going beyond that and considering caste itself as a human rights problem is something that we find many civil rights organizations are not willing to do, and they feel quite uncomfortable. But I had strange experience is a peculiar experience. So when one starts looking at caste as a social institution and its impact on all other social institutions, how it perverts the democratic content of every institution, one develops a certain way of looking at things. I was in Calcutta once as a guest of the local civil rights organization, the APDR, and they had a case going on in the High Court. So I just went there and I was sitting with them. They were complaining about the judge. The case was about the custodial killing of a rickshaw puller or somebody, and they were just commenting that the judge is a little negative, not very sensitive and so on. They were sitting behind. I casually asked the secretary of the organization, what is the judge's caste? I thought it was relevant when he is saying that the judge's prejudice has a negative attitude. I thought it was relevant, but that friend got very upset. He said, why do you ask the caste of a judge? He is a judge, he doesn't have a caste. He is a judge, okay, but he doesn't have a caste. He is both, whatever he is. That man refused to even answer what could be the caste of the judge. This one can easily guess from the name and all that if one is a local person. So if one is to understand why this is this kind of a resistance is there, so one has to go into the background of the present civil rights movement in India. The existing civil rights organizations and movement in India, I think, had its origin in two kinds of political context which developed in the early 1970s. A by about late 60s, 70s, I think a general disillusionment with the establishment politics identified with the Congress Party had come up in the country, and all kinds of alternatives were coming forward. And within this context, though there were plenty of attempts prior to that to form civil rights organization, especially whenever the Communist Party was subjected to repression, it floated civil rights forums, which existed so long as the repression was there, and then they closed down. This happened very frequently. Similarly, every political formation which faced repression formed the civil rights organizations of its own. There was a Hindu civil rights union in Hyderabad when the Razakar attacked on not only Hindus but also those Muslims who differed from the Nizam of Hyderabad, when they were going on. The Arya Samaj established a Hindu civil rights organization in Hyderabad. Subsequently, it became defunct after Hyderabad became part of India. Such efforts were there. But after 1970, a series of civil rights organizations came up, which have all practically continued to this day. And for this history, there is a political party, or two political parties. One is the Bihar movement of students and youth led by, or guided by, Jayaprakash Narayan against Mrs. Gandhi's corruption, despotism, and hired the henchmen in Bihar and so on. That movement was suppressed very violently by Congress government. I think 200 to 300 students and youth died in police firing in a short period in Bihar camps. That was the context in which, I mean, the leader or the guiding light of the movement was Jayaprakash Narayan. And Justice Tharkunde has always been close to Jayaprakash Narayan. That was the context in which Justice Tharkunde came forward and gave a call for creating a civil rights movement. That is that when students and youth come into the streets to fight corrupt and despotic governments, they react by sending the paramilitary and shooting them down and so on. And various oppressive legislation are also used. And that was the genesis of what is today PUCM, People's Union for Civil Liberties. That's how it, I think 1974 was the year the organization took birth. So its political context was the JP-led movement in Bihar and partly Gujarat, and the concerns it gave rise to in terms of civil rights. The movement itself was a wider political movement, a part of a search for an alternative to Congress Party. But a suppression that was subjected to gave rise to the strong civil rights concern led by Mr. Tharkunde. And then the PUCL was born, and of course afterwards it has taken up a wide range of issues. This is one political context. Another political context is of course the Naxalite uprising. It began in Bengal, spread to Bihar and Andhra Pradesh. And the response of the government was not to answer the social economic questions raised by that movement, not to remedy the social and economic situations pointed out by that movement, but to suppress. Encounters have been continuing, even today they continue in Andhra and also in Bihar. And preventive detention laws were used very extensively. Criminal conspiracy, I think sections of criminal conspiracy sections of the Indian criminal law were extensively misused in the context of Naxalite. All political activity, any meeting like this would be called like criminal conspiracy to work for the state, and all people would put inside there. This again gave rise to a civil rights concern. That in dealing with this political movement, armed struggle with the aims of the communist system, the state was using thoroughly undemocratic method, extrajudicial execution, what used to be called black laws and so on. This gave rise to civil rights law. So in West Bengal and Andhra Pradesh, civil rights organizations were formed, APCLC was part of that. Subsequently, as time progressed, other organizations also took shape in other parts of the country. These two streams, which have led to the present civil rights movement in India, they have a philosophical, ideological background. The first one may loosely call liberal democracy, though it's difficult to pinpoint Jayaprakash Narayan or Tharkunde's outlook as such and such a strain of liberal democracy, but basically it's within a broad framework which one may call liberal democracy. The second is the Marxist framework. Now both these frameworks have their specific points and perhaps specific limitations also. Because of the nature of these frameworks, the civil rights movement took up certain concerns as basic, certain concerns as secondary concerns, certain as not concerns at all. That's how it came. When we look back at our organization's original manifesto, what is it that was defined as civil rights issue? Or what is it that was identified as the context from which a civil rights problem would arise? That was suppression of workers and peasants by the state, by the capitalists, and by the landlords. This is the framework which was laid down for identifying civil rights problem in APCLC's original manifesto. So you have workers and peasants identified as economic categories, class categories, their assertions suppressed by capitalists, landlords, and state. And from this, a variety of civil rights problems arise. And we had about an 8-point statement of aims and objectives for APCLC within this context, which clearly comes from a Marxist context. Similarly, PUCL, I have not seen their manifesto, but if one goes through their initial activity, not subsequent or present activity, but initial activity, it was concerned with the institutions of parliamentary democracy, judiciary, lawlessness of the police force, which again, I mean, many of these concerns may become partly the concerns of the framework within which APCLC and APDR and OPDR and organizations could work. But this was a slightly different kind of thing. So what is remarkable is that neither of these frameworks had a place for caste as a basic civil rights issue. There is no reason at all why the civil rights movement in India should have taken birth only this way. It could have happened different. So happened like this. So happened that these were the context which gave rise to civil rights concern in India. Though much before this, certain basic concepts, which I think today, at least APCLC accepts and many people would accept, were formulated by, for instance, Ambedkar, when he was talking of democracy. One point he would repeatedly say is that so long as caste is there, there cannot be democracy. When caste is there, a society which is ridden by caste can never become a democratic society. So this could have been the starting point of a civil rights movement. It did not happen. For a variety of reasons, I am sure one important reason is that it was the upper caste persons, upper caste liberal, democratic minded, progressive people who were the first persons to initiate the civil rights movement. And none of them had experienced either untouchability or any kind of caste oppression. And none of them had direct contacts, a direct sympathy, ideological, political sympathy with anti-caste movement, like the Republican Party of India or so on. And therefore, the civil rights movement that they created took shape within different frameworks. Those frameworks also had their own history and their own logic, and that logic, for a variety of reasons, did not have a place for caste as a civil rights issue. That's how things were. But then when you get into the issue, you start asking yourself why you are opposing, for instance, the state violence is something that is very commonly taken up as a major issue by civil rights organizations. But why do we oppose state violence? Why do we oppose undemocratic legislation? Why do we oppose this and this when we take up this issue? So these things gradually throw up a lot of questions. Now, if you give one answer to a question and that answer has logical implications which go beyond the answer that you have given, you are forced also to take into consideration all those logical implications. We would be frequently asked, I remember when I came, I was new to it, because people frequently used to ask, is not untouchability a major civil rights issue? Why is it not there in your land? So what does untouchability do? What does caste in general do? It denies civic status. And civic status is the beginning of civil rights. If you talk of policemen torturing somebody in a police station, you are presuming a subject who has civic status. Somebody who has been tortured is a person who already possesses the status of a civilian. Somebody who is being arrested under National Security Act already possesses the status of a civilian. That civic status is presumed whenever you talk about civilian. But caste is something which by its very nature denies civic status itself, that you are not an equal citizen. Your civil status is half of mine, it is one quarter of mine, it is one tenth of mine. With this kind of a system, how is it that your civil rights concern does not take up caste itself as a civil rights issue? This is a question that frequently used to be asked by persons from an American viewpoint, and we would have, many of us would feel uncomfortable, because some answer has to be given. Within the framework that we were accustomed, We would say that these are not questions which a civil rights movement can answer. Only a social transformation can bring about the changes, and we will help to protect the rights of those who are fighting for social transformation. This was the standard answer we used to give in the beginning. But only social transformation can get rid of caste. We cannot do anything to get rid of caste. And therefore, our task is to see that those who are fighting for social transformation, their political rights are protected, and that becomes a civil rights cause. This is the answer we frequently used to give. But then it was not a really satisfactory answer, partly because when we talk about, say, encounters or lockup days, we are not able to put in into either encounters or lockup. In a sense, that's also not part of something that can be achieved by the civil rights movement. Still we are doing it. Why are we doing it? When you take up any civil rights issue, it has never been the understanding of the civil rights movement that we can find a solution to the issue. All that we have been able to do is to create awareness about it, to create a democratic critic about it, to give confidence, purpose to people to fight, and if possible to create institutions and institutional culture which will mitigate the evils of those institutions, undemocratic institutions and others. These are all that the civil rights movement has been able to do in any context. So why can't it do the same thing also about caste? Instead of saying that only social transformation will get rid of caste, in the meantime we will only talk about state violence. Even state violence we can't get rid of. But still why are we talking about it? This is the debate that we used to frequently. By campaigning against untouchability, we are not going to get rid of untouchability, but that's quite true. But by campaigning against encounters, we have not been able to get rid of encounters. What have we been able to do? There are a few things we have been able to do. One is to create an awareness that extrajudicial killing cannot be permitted in a civilized society. Whatever crime somebody has committed, he has to be tried according to law, cannot be taken away and shot dead. This is an awareness we have been able to create. We have also been able to create a certain amount of confidence in people that this is right, what we are saying, and we should stand up for. It is something that we ought to stand up for, that confidence we have been able to create, or we can create. We can also try to create a general democratic critic of police excesses, which we have been able to do. And also finally to create institutions, institutional culture, to improve institutions, like when we function in courts, we using a court for civil liberties purposes also improves the court and makes it more of a civil rights forum, 1% or 2% or 5%. So if this is the activity that we are able to do about state violence, why can't we do the same thing about the variety of other civil rights issues which come? This is the debate that gradually, I mean, today I am able to formulate it so clearly, it was never so clear in the beginning. Gradually the thing came. And then from this point of view, if one looks back at what Ambedkar said, that when what is remarkable about Hindu society is not that it is stratified, all societies are stratified. Of course it is stratified much more absolutely than other societies. But I think most significant part of Hinduism is that whereas every religion has sanctioned inequality by various means, by giving it various explanations, various ideological explanations, Hinduism alone has said God himself has created inequality, you can't do anything about it. No other religion has said that God himself has created people unequal. They have defended inequality by various other means, by various mechanisms and devices. Hinduism alone said, or made God himself say in the Bhagavad Gita, that I have created people unequal. There's nothing else you can do. So this is a society which, after all, the role that in an ideal modern liberal society, the constitution and law has to play, in medieval society God plays. And if God himself declares that people are unequal, by birth, by creation, by the will of God, now that acts as a very powerful justification. It gets into the minds of people and acts as a very powerful justification for inequality. And this denial of civic status as a fundamental thing is a very remarkable quality of Hinduism. And today I think that any civil rights concern in India should start with this. It can go to other things subsequently, because after all, historically, the first civil rights question which came up, at least after civilized society took birth in India, is the question of caste. Subsequently, we got a modern state and after Britishers came, and therefore we have the problems of modern states, authoritarianism, which is common with Western countries and other countries. Then also we have the development of capitalism, which creates the problems of labor, economic exploitation and deprival of livelihood to people. That creates other problems. But this country, lack of democracy began with caste. And patriarchy, which is part of the same development. But in Hindu society, it's difficult to divide patriarchy from caste, because you look at the Dharma Shastra, the two are totally intertwined. It's very difficult to talk about the domination of men or women without bringing caste into the question. And difficult to talk about caste without bringing domination of men or women into the question. The two are equal. So I think today I feel that if one is talk of civil rights concern in India, it should begin with Brahminical Hinduism and its context, the context it has defined. And that's where it comes forward. And this is the point Ambedkar made long ago. And I am sure it is quite true that it has remained outside the understanding of civil rights movement, definitely for the reason that all of us are people from the upper caste. Then those of us who came to the movement in the beginning. It's only today that backward caste and Dalit intellectuals are coming forward into the civil rights movement. That's the problem. Now, when one looks at it this way, a society which denies civic status as a matter of theory, as a matter of principle, as a matter of philosophy, as a matter of religion, such a society can never become democratic. As our friend was saying, such a society can never become democratic until that division is annihilated, until that division is completely got rid of. Now this is something which has, I think, to become central to the understanding of the task of the civil rights movement. Task of civil rights movement cannot be reduced to only fighting state violence so that those political parties or organizations which want to fight for a better society are unable to do so. That's fine. Those who want to fight for a better society must have political rights and we must defend their political rights. But that cannot be the only task of civil rights movement as today, at least as APCLC understands, that we have a broader framework for all. And that task is to define democracy, not merely in terms of police and police misbehavior and police atrocities, but to define democracy widely, political, administrative, social, economic, familial, define it widely and try to build ideas about democracy, a democratic critique of existing institutions and cultures, the willpower, the self-confidence and the courage required to fight these things, and the institutions and institutional culture, institutional norms, which may be able to either overcome these things or to mitigate these things. This can be the framework of the civil rights movement. And when one understands things this way, taking democracy understood social, political, administrative, economic and so on as the framework, caste becomes a very important part of the understanding of the civil rights issue. And the fight against caste, even from the civil rights point of view, the agitation or fight against caste acquires many dimensions other than merely opposing atrocities on that. Atrocities on that is something that, as far as I know, all civil rights organizations in India are investigating, trying to get cases booked and trying to help the victim. That's fine. But then if you understand caste itself as a central civil rights question as one ought to, the concern has to go beyond. A few I would like to indicate so that hopefully in future we will be able to take up these issues and bit. But I would like to tell the history of our own realization of this issue, because we didn't realize it so very fast. For a long time we were concerned. A volume of APCLC's initial reports is here. Some copies have been sent to PDF also. If you look at that volume, until 1985 or 84, we were concerned with a single point agenda. That was that the communist revolutionaries are fighting for social transformation and their rights are being suppressed. They are being killed in fake encounters, arrested, charged with false cases, conspiracy cases and so on. We were agitating about it. That used to be our theme. We would never talk about other undemocratic aspects of public life or private life in our society. We would regard that as something which has to be achieved after the revolution comes. In the meantime, we would fight for the rights of revolutionaries. We never wrote it on this way, but that was the understanding that we commonly had. But then gradually issues came up and we had to face and answer those issues and our own understanding them. The major, I think, starting point was the massacre of Dalits in Karam Chedu, a village in Prakasham district, where A.T. Rama Rao was then Chief Minister of Andhra Pradesh. His close relatives, his son-in-law is from that village, who is now with Lakshmi Parvati. He is one of the leaders of our party. He is a member of Rajya Sabha. Those people killed six Dalits. The initial projection of the issue, today it would have been projected as atrocities on Dalits, but in those days it was not like that even in the common sense. The projection was that Congress voters have been killed. The TDP has killed Congress voters because they are Congress voters. But then it was obvious that after every Congress voter is not being killed. They are killed because they are not only Congress voters, but they are also Dalits. They are Dalits in a village controlled by very powerful Kamma landlord, very rich people who are in the Madras film business and all kinds of things. For the first time, APCLC as an organization went on a fact-finding for an issue other than police atrocity. We just went there. We went there and we didn't understand why we were going there, to be very frank. This is something we had never done in the past. We went there, we collected information, we held a press conference in Vijayawada, gave a press release, said that all the assailants must be immediately arrested, and then we came back. We didn't fully understand why we had done this, but we did it. After all, Congress people and TDP people killing each other takes place in Andhra very few. Andhra is a much more violent state than Karnataka. Not in nationalists, but everybody deals in violence in Andhra. Still, we had never taken up those issues. For the first time we did. Then after I came back, I was still teaching in Warangal. One of my students came. He was an ABVP fellow. Very deliberately he came and said, "Sir, you have done a very good thing. I saw your statement in the paper. Those Kammas are very bad. They have killed these Dalits. The term Dalit was not used in those days. They have killed these Harijans. It's very good you have gone there. In our village, Harijans have killed a reddy. Will you come for fact finding? Deliberately here." I said, "No, I won't." I don't know why I answered that. I said, why won't you come? Then I remember my answer. You reduce your connections to the police. So if you are killed, you go and give a police complaint, police will come and arrest them. In the case of Harijans, they won't have police connections, so they can't give a police complaint, police will not help them. I think in the beginning, our understanding of why we had taken up issues of atrocities and Dalits were that Dalits don't have the help of the police, whereas upper caste have the help of the police. And since we are concerned with police atrocities, it gets linked that police are helping one section, they are not helping the other section. And we are concerned with police atrocities, and therefore we take up these issues of killing of Dalits to upper caste. That's how we understood it in the beginning. But I think very soon we realize this is a very artificial way of looking at the problem. That here is a question of power. It's a question of power. Some people have power, some people don't have power. We are concerned about state violence because state has power over our lives. And power has to be accounted. Power has to be, ultimately we hope there will be no power in society, but then so long as power is there, it has to be accountable. It has to be accountable not only to the public at large, it has to be accountable to certain laid down norms, which we call democratic principles, democratic norms, law, whatever you want to call it. This applies not only to the East, it applies to everything. The state has to be accountable to democratic norms. The owner of a factory, though he is a private citizen, he also has to be accountable when he deals with his workers to the law, to democratic norms, to democratic principles, to the basic livelihood rights of the workers. Similarly, when we talk of caste gives power to upper caste. And that power therefore equally becomes a civil rights concern, just as state power becomes a civil rights concern. Similarly, a man and a family has power over them. Whether he is as husband, as father, even as brother, he has power over his children. So this power also has to be accountable to democratic principles. Ultimately, the power should go and there should be equality, but it's a process. In the process, you hold that power accountable to certain principles. You weaken that power. You try to get rid of that power. You try to question the legitimacy of that power. Why should that power be there? Why should caste be there? Why should domination of men or women be there? But this becomes a civil rights question as much as questioning the power of the state. This is something that over a period only we understood. In the beginning we did not. One major issue which came up in those days was that NTR was chief minister, there was a backward class commission called Murali Kharnal Commission. That man gave a report saying that reservations for backward caste in state sector should be increased from 26% to 44% in Andhra. This is a report that he gave. It led to a big furor in Andhra. Upper caste students, especially those who belong to Enti Ramarao's caste community, they came out into the streets and all over coastal Andhra, they had massive rasta roko, road roko, policemen would not touch them, they would not arrest them. It was a big situation. It became a question mark for APC. What do we do? Do we see it as a student agitation against government policy? If it is student agitation against government policy, we are concerned about the rights of those students. Even otherwise, if they are lati charged unnecessarily or shot down unnecessarily, we will take it up as an issue. But do we see it basically as a student agitation against the government, a policy of the government, or an exhibition of upper caste arrogance? How do we see it? This is a discussion we had for a long time in our organization. We were not able to clinch it. Those of us who believe that this is not to be treated primarily as a student movement, but as an exhibition of upper caste arrogance, and has to be criticized from that point, though we do defend their right to take out a meeting, hold a morcha or hold a meeting and so on. But the content of their demand is an undemocratic, anti-democratic content that has to be opposed as a democratic principle. Some of us who believed that, though we were main office bearers of the APCC, we could not even publish a pamphlet in those days. So in the name of Reservation Protection Committee, we had brought out 10,000 pamphlets distributed in the state without using the name of APCC. That was the situation in those days. Because you see, earlier we had already taken up issues of atrocities and Dalits. But then we didn't fully understand why we had taken it. When this came up, we didn't understand what. Then gradually the understanding, incident to incident, event to event, the understanding started developing. And what I just briefly described, that the understanding of caste as a form of power, as a form of authority, as a form of domination, which is built into the social structure, just as the power, the domination of the state is built into our society, its structure, social, political structure. And wherever power is exercised, the question of rights, whatever the source of the power. Source of the power can be constitutional, it can be social, it can be cultural, it can be a gun in your hands. Wherever power is exercised in an institutionalized way, the question of civil rights arises. It arises in different forms and different contexts. When it's a question of domination over women by men in the family, it arises in one form. When it's a question of caste domination, the form is different. When it's a question of domination of a policeman over the locality where he is the sub-inspector of police, it arises in a different way. Basically, it's a question of power. This understanding developed only gradually. By the time the Mandal Commission came, we had no difficulty about taking a stand and taking a widespread publicity in defense of the Mandal Commission and in opposing whatever arguments were being given by the upper caste section, denigrating the Mandal Commission, denigrating the reservation. I want to emphasize that today, just as many ideas which have come from the liberal tradition, many ideas which have come from the Marxist tradition have become part of the understanding of the civil rights movement. Many thoughts of Ambedkar also have to become part of the civil rights movement. Especially, one of the special qualities of Ambedkar was that he was not only an opponent of the Hindu caste system as a Dalit, he was an opponent as a Democrat. Very often Ambedkar's ideas are presented as the ideas of a Dalit intellectual fighting caste. It's true. But going beyond that, he was one of the greatest Democrats, a person who was thoroughly and completely convinced about the best democratic principles which have come from the European Enlightenment and European Democratic Revolution. And that critic you can find very frequently. The two get mixed when he writes. In Ambedkar writings, you have a Dalit critic of caste system and a Democrat critic of an undemocratic system. The two merge very neatly and very well. And that critic has to become part of the understanding of the civil rights. Because until and unless the caste as a system, caste as a culture, caste as a complex of social relations is totally annihilated, there cannot be democracy in India. We can have elections. I am not the denigrating elections. Elections have to be there. There has to be some mode of political expression for people to choose. I mean, whether it's one gunda or another gunda, even that choice is a good thing. Hopefully a non-gunda will come up one day or the other. That's okay. I am not denigrating elections. But that is not the end of democracy. There has to be, as I said, as Ambedkar himself said, civic status is the beginning of civil liberty. When you say, talk of civil liberty, who is the subject? Who is the person? The person for whom civil liberty is the predicate. That subject is a person who has civic status. You have to be a human being, you have to be a citizen to have civil liberty. Now we have a culture which says you are not a human. So where is the question of civil liberty? If it is denied that you are a human being at all, if it is said you are a 5% human being, you are a 10% human being, only a few people are 100% human being, where is the question of civil rights arise? Who is the subject of the, who holds those rights? Even in within what's called bourgeois law, there is a subject who holds rights, a subject who is entitled to rights. Who is that subject? The major premise of bourgeois democracy is that there is a all subjects, all people who live in a society have equal civic entitlement to rights, whether they actually get those rights or not. Whether they get those rights or not is a question of their economic power, how much property they have, what kind of jobs they have, whether they have a job or not, and so on. But civic status, which is the starting point of entitlement for rights, that is presumed by the notion of bourgeois civil. But here we have a society where the civic status itself is denied. You are not a human being, 10% of the population. Another 10% are 5% human beings, 95% are not human beings. And the percentage which you are a human being keeps gradually increasing until only Brahmins are 100% human. So this kind of society cannot bear democracy, cannot be the bearer of democracy. For it, democracy cannot be a predicate unless this system of caste is annihilated. This is an idea, very powerful idea which comes from Ambedkar's right. And this idea has to become part of the understanding of the civil rights movement. So hopefully, APCLC, we are able to integrate this idea. We have a lot of differences. I mean, there are some people who resign from the organization saying this is becoming anti-ready, anti-Kamma organization. That's fine. If you think you are ready, you go. If you are born ready, you have no objection. If you think you are ready, you go off and down. You have been born in any caste. So long as you understand that caste is undemocratic and you are prepared to work against caste, work for the annihilation of caste, welcome wherever you are born. But if you say, I am going out because the APCS has become anti-ready organization, that means you are regarding yourself as ready. Then don't be. You have no place. So we had to lose a few people. But I think organization as a whole today has come to accept this. Having said this, I would like to formulate a few things which have come as part of our experience, which are problems as well as certain issues we have to deal with. One thing that we find very common in Andhra Pradesh today is these two issues which have become very, very much part of political concern today, that is women's rights and Dalit rights. These two have become very much part of political concern all over the country, a very good development in the last 10 years. But these two are being set against each other in many contexts. Very often we find that when you go to a village where there has been a complaint that untouchability is being practiced against Dalit or some physical assault has taken place against Dalit, there is often a counter complaint from the upper caste that the Dalits have harassed upper caste women, that the Dalits have raped an upper caste girl. This is a very common complaint. It has become so common that when we go to a village and factually we expect that has to be. There was a very major killing of Dalits in a village called Chundu in Guntur district in 1991, August. Now that incident, the justification for the killing given by the upper caste was that the Dalit boys had become very arrogant, they are very undisciplined, they are harassing upper caste girls, they don't say upper caste, they are harassing women, they won't say upper caste women, they are harassing women, many women have been raped. And the way this was, as I said, you can never separate the women question and the caste question in Indian culture. So in that village, the complaint was a Brahmin woman has been raped. See, any woman being raped and a Brahmin woman being raped are not the same thing. Brahmin woman being raped in our culture is something much more horrible than some other woman being raped. So in Chundur, the first thing that they said was a Brahmin woman has been raped. This to create the most negative image that is possible to be given. Manodharma Shastra says that even if a Dalit, if Shudra falls in love with a Brahmin woman and has sexual intercourse with her, his penis has to be cut and he has to be, it's no question of even rape. That is the biggest thing that is possible to imagine in Brahminical dharma. And nobody in Chundur has read Dharma Shastra, but this is part of our culture. We talk of Manu and why we should oppose Manodharma Shastra, not that people are reading the book. It has become so much part of our culture and understanding that it's everybody has a Manu sitting inside his mind. And this argument was given up in that village, and when we went on fact finding, we thought it's very easy. How many Brahmins will be there in any village? 33 or so. It's very easy to find. So we went to those 3 or 4 families and tried to find out, has any woman in your house been there? But there were only 2 families in the village. They said, nothing has been there. Then we tried to find whether any woman at all in the village has been there. Nothing. But this had spread already, spread very wide. That Dalits had, even if a woman has been raped, doesn't mean that they can all be massacred and killed. Still, it gives them some kind of a moral justification in terms of the kind of morality prevalent in society. So this was used. But subsequently, we have found that it's not just spreading a rumor. Counter cases are being made. Because this is something that is very difficult for Dalits. You are attacked, you are subjected to humiliation, you are subjected to untouchability, you go and give a police complaint. That fellow becomes accused. Then he goes and gives a police complaint saying that you have come and molested the women of their families or something. You are also accused. Policemen are very happy to. Any time counter complaints, police are happy because they can get money from both sides. That's the general habit of the police. So he is also happy to file case against. But then what is your situation? What is the situation of other fellow? He can afford to go to court once in 10 days, 15 days. But you have to give up your job, your work, your labor and go and sit in the court. Which means it acts as a pressure for public. Counter case is filed and then fillers are sent out. You forget your case, we'll forget our case. That is the end of the matter. Very frequently, Dalits are forced to come to a compromise, settle to become hostile in court if at all the case comes up for trial, merely by filing a counter case using the question of atrocities on women as a weapon against Dalits who protest about atrocities on them. This has become a very common thing in Andhra Pradesh. I'm sure it is there here also if you take up the issues and go to it. Sometimes the reverse also happens. Sometimes, not as frequently as this, sometimes it does happen. There was a case where one headmaster in a high school in Guntur district, he was accused of molesting a girl. He actually did it, but then he used the daughter, he did it. And the sarpanch of the village was an upper caste man who found out this and gave a police complaint. The inspector also happened to be an upper caste man. So he used his Dalit status to try to get rid of the molestation or atrocities that he had tried to perpetrate on the school. But this happens less frequently because this kind of situation also doesn't arise so frequently as the other arises. And that is a very common thing, it has become very common. In many situations, we had to have campaign against counter cases. Campaign against counter cases to talk to the superintendent of police, the collector, the local SI, that you can't go on registering every case which is given to you and then try to force them to compromise outside the police. This cannot be. So this, I think, is one of the major problems is coming up when we take up the issues of untouchability. The other is a certain attitude to what happens in these situations. After all, why is it that both the women question and Dalit question today are taken up as serious political questions in India? One very obvious reason is that from both these sections of society, people have come forward. Educated people, MLAs, MPs, ministers, vocal people have come forward who are asserting the rights of their caste or women as a group. And it has forced the whole of society to rethink about these things, to make some amends, to make some accommodation, to pass some Panchayat Raj bill to give 1/3 seats to women in sarpanch posts and so on, to create legislation. It has come up from the women's movement and Dalit movement. This pressure has come up from society to make some amends and some kind of accommodation. But whenever that is done, what happens is, power is not in their hands still. They are asserting their right to power. They are asserting their right to equality and justice. But power is in the hands of other people who will accommodate because it's impossible not to accommodate when somebody is struggling against you. You do accommodate, but then you accommodate in a dishonest way. You make some law, you don't implement. You make some law, you allow it to be perverted in fact. In Andhra Pradesh, our experience is that this Scheduled Caste, Scheduled Tribe Prevention of Atrocities Act, what is commonly called SCST Act, the implementation of that act has been extremely unsatisfactory because of this dishonest attitude of the administration. For instance, that act says that there has to be a special court for SCST offences in every district. Now, there are many legislations which provide for special courts. One is the TADA, It provides for special court neutrality. TADA was enacted in 1985 July. In August, we had special court neutrality. But when SCST Act comes into force in 1989, it also says special courts in every district. For 2 years, there are no special courts. Then suddenly, Sundur massacre takes people start, people like us give press statements saying that they should all be booked under SCST Act and sent to special courts. Where are the special courts? They are not there. We had all thought it is there because Act came 2 years ago. No special courts are there. Then there is a registration for special courts by that organization. Then the Chief Minister, he says, I will set up 3 special courts in the 3 regions of Andhra Pradesh, Coastal Andhra, Rayalaseema and Telangana. And those who don't know the act think that he is doing a favor. So look at Janardan Reddy is a good man. He is setting up special courts for us. We try to tell people there is a provision in the law for one special court for each district. He is setting up for 3 regions. And that is very inconvenient because you have a region consisting of 9 districts. You have one special court. If you are the witness, you have been assaulted, you are the victim. A victim becomes a witness in the criminal trial. And your friend is also a victim. As witness, you have to go there, cross 3 or 4 districts and spend a whole day going and giving evidence in the court. The court in its beneficiaries may give you money, it may not give you money. So this was also, it was very, very, very inconvenient. And then the most corrupt officers were posted to those courts. There is a public prosecutor in Mahbub Nagar, the court for Telangana. That fellow had practically opened a shop, as they used to say. Saying that you give this much, I'll say no objection to bail, you can take bail and go there. You give this much, I'll see that charges are not prosecuted. Open. And Bar Association passed resolutions against these fellows saying they are corrupt. And this is a court which is set up for protecting the rights of weaker sections of society. The state allows corrupt people to continue to be there in spite of resolutions and protests. This kind of a perversion has taken place all over. Apparently what they have done is, they have said, having perverted it, it has become very bad. So what we will do is, the first additional district judge of every district will be, I mean, he will be nominated as a special judge, no special court, but the first ADJ of every district will be automated. That's the situation it has come to now. So this perversion of the rights are fought for, they are achieved. Those who are in power, they don't want to give those rights. What they do is, they create some kind of an institutional setup and they perverse. It becomes part of our job to see that, civil rights movement job to see that. This kind of institutional perversion does not take. You can do it in a variety of ways. There are various ways of doing it. Especially many civil rights organizations have lots of lawyers who are part of the system. To function in those courts, to help the people, to try to see if they function properly, this can be a major problem. One can give many such examples of problems which come up in this kind of institution. So finally, I will have to end with one appeal for one demand, which I think is a very crucial demand, which has to be taken up. This concerns reservation. So we all remember the whole agitation about Mandal Commission. How viciously and virulently it was opposed by upper caste people, especially North India, because in South people have got accustomed to reservation. North, it is still very fresh for them. How they opposed. Then finally, the commission, the Supreme Court also upheld the thing with some reservations anyway. It's getting implemented. But while the whole thing has been going on, what has been happening on the other side is, reservations till now have been confined only to public sector. And there is agitation, there are movements, there are statutes, there are laws, there are Supreme Court judgments, ultimately saying that it's all very fine to give reservations in public sector. In the meanwhile, public sector has gone. In the meanwhile, public sector has gone, everything is getting private. So today, Mandal Commission comes into force very fine. It gives reservations in telecommunication. But where is telecommunication? It's in the hands of Himachal Futuristic, whatever it is called, who is now hosting the sponsoring today's election results announcement by Pranay Roy and others. So public sector has gone just at the time when the Dalits and backward caste people developed a section within them who could vocally come forward, agitate, fight. But then there's nothing in the Indian constitution which says that reservations have to be confined only to the public sector. Article 15.4, 16.4 is by the plain reading, give complete justification for reservations in the private sector also as much as in the public sector. And if one takes a look at private sector, we are collecting a survey in Andhra Pradesh to take up a campaign on this. In the private sector, we all perfectly know what is happening. Whatever is the caste of the fellow who sets up the unit, he brings his caste people only for the important jobs. Only for menial work, he allows local people to come, so maybe people of backward caste, scheduled caste. And you don't find a single woman accepting an occasional typist in any private sector, factory or any such institution. So we are conducting a survey of how many jobs are given to backward caste, scheduled caste people, and to women in the private sector, either industries or in college. Especially, at least in industry, sometimes they require people who have competence. In educational institutions, nobody thinks competence is required. So you are ready, set up a college, all jobs are given to ready. I'm sure Vakaligal set up a college, all jobs are given to Vakaligal, irrespective of merit, because nobody thinks merit is required in a college. So this case, so we are conducting a survey and we will do it. But I think today the civil rights movement, I believe Janata Dal has passed a resolution that they are going to do this. Whether they do it, when they come to power, one doesn't know. In opposition, they pass a resolution. But a civilized movement has to take up a major demand. As I said, it's not that we are going to achieve. You know, we have not been able to achieve putting a full stop to encounters or lock up deaths or anything. What we have been able to achieve is to create a public opinion in society that we are people who are disinterested in the sense that we are not with one political party or any political party. We are not doing this for the sake of election. Civil rights movement is talking in terms of principle. As a matter of principle, we have been able to convince society that this is arbitrary exercise of power by the police will not do. They cannot pick up somebody and shoot him dead and say he is an Azulai. They cannot torture somebody, kill him in police lockup and say he is a dacoit. If he is a dacoit, there is a court to declare that, not him. Police cannot do. We have been able to spread this idea in society. And we have been able to create certain institutions, to strengthen certain institutions. After all, the National Human Rights Commission has come into being, partly because of pressure from the United Nations and so on, partly also because of the civil rights movement in India, which has been consistently putting pressure for the creation of a judicial body which will investigate or at least inquire into offences by police and paramilitary. And today in Andhra Pradesh, we filed a writ petition in the High Court about encounters, in which we asked the High Court to declare that one human rights court has to be set up in every district. Not merely to inquire into, but to try and prosecute police officers. Last 3 months ago, Chandrababu Naidu declared that we have human rights courts in the form of an additional district judge in every district. So this kind of creation of institutions, creation of institutional culture, all this confidence which we have been able to do in the case of police atrocities and TADA and so on, equal opportunity has been achieved, partial equality opportunity has been achieved through reservations. But in the public sector has gone, everything is getting privatized very fast in the country. So a major movement for reservations in the private sector, for women, for Dalits, for backward castes, for tribals is required. And while the civil rights movement cannot itself create that kind of a movement, we can create a climate for that kind of a movement, create support, sympathy, justification, legitimacy for that kind of a movement. I think that's a very important task, and in the context of new economic policy, in the context of liberalization, restructuring of the economy, I think this is a very important task linked to the general struggle for the annihilation of Kerala. So this is a movement that we in Andhra are taking up. We are doing a survey and we want to take up a campaign. We are hoping that it will be taken up by either PDF and also Democratic minded people outside. But that is it. And this is where I said that when one talks of caste, it's not just a question of opposing atrocities on Dalits. From atrocities on Dalits to a campaign for reservation in the private sector is a very long journey. But then that journey can be made if you understand caste as by itself, in itself, by its very nature, a denial of democracy. Then you'll understand that merely killing of Dalits in the villages by upper caste people or Savarna Hindu, that is not the only atrocity in relation to caste. Any consequence of caste as a system, any consequence of caste as a hierarchical and democratic system, caste as a mode of power, any such consequence is undemocratic. And one of the undemocratic consequences of caste, because the whole basis of caste or the logic of caste in our country has been that everybody is allotted one dharma and you have to stick to that dharma. Whereas liberty and freedom require, they demand that everyone should be free to choose what he or she would like. Everyone should be free to choose what he or she should spend one's creative talent. And Hindu dharma is exactly the opposite of this. You are confined to this, you are this and you have to be. And that has created inherent social, cultural drawbacks for people who are born in backward castes or scheduled castes in terms of education, because education was something that was systematically in terms of Hindu dharma denied. In practice, of course, dharma may not have been implemented 100% and many that is may have got educated, that is a different matter. But as a matter of principle, as a matter of the guiding philosophical principle of society, this was denied. And if that has to be annihilated, equal opportunity for education. Equal opportunity for education in a country where education was supposed to be in theory confined only to Brahmins. That becomes a major task for the as part of the annihilation of caste, and therefore also a task for civil rights movement. Education, employment and dignity and status in society and so on. So that has to be taken up in the context of economic restructuring, as reservations in the private sector, as a movement has to be taken up, and we are trying to create some literature. We will be sending it to you all. I think I will stop here and give you time to ask some questions and interrogate. Thank you. You see, say that we are opposed to the whole policy of liberalization and therefore demanding reservations in private sector goes against it. I don't think it makes much sense, because even as we fight against private ownership of means of production, we also ask for gratuity and bonus, which presupposes private ownership of means of production. The demands of the workers within industry are taken up along with the fight against the existence of this kind of a private industry that has been taken up for a long time. It can be, these two, there is no contradiction between them. Apart from there not being any contradiction, this demand for reservations in the private sector can also help the fight against privatization, because If the government tomorrow, if Janata Dal tomorrow comes to power in this National Front, Left Front coalition, if that right or not, it will be opposed by the World Bank and the because it's part of the Dakel proposals, which have now become part of, practically part of international non-existent implicit statute, that there will be no restrictions on the freedom of capital, and reservation is a restriction on freedom of capital. So any reservation, the private sector will be opposed by the present new economic world order. Therefore, it will be one of the weapons against that order. It will in fact expose very clearly that order has no concern with those who are working. It has no concern with those who need jobs, those who want jobs, those who are prepared to work for their livelihood, whether they get livelihood or not. This international economic order has no concern. That will come out very clearly when we take up this, because it will be a part of the Dankel proposal. For instance, no fair price shops. Our government has earned a 5-year respite. That we require some time to close down all the fair price shops, because the thing is that one of the items is that everything has to be purchased and sold only at market price by the government, which means fair price shops don't have to be. They would have been closed down by now after our government signed the Dankel thing. But they can ask for 5 years' time. Maybe it will ask for some more time. So this can also be a way of exposing the new economic policy and all. And moreover, there has never been any perceived contradiction between long-term demand for abolishing a certain institution and intermediate demands for creating more rights within that institution. The two can go together. The same also works for NHRC or anything. We would like to have a situation where policemen don't commit any atrocities. But as part of the struggle, we demand institutions which will take them to task, which will hold them responsible when they commit atrocities. So every demand which is granted by the state may thereby create legitimacy for the state. But that is no reason for us to give up any demand or not to fight for institutional change. It happens to anything. After all, Vishwanath Pratap Singh spoke about Mandal Commission. He gave them some legitimacy to his government. It will. When people struggle, people fight for something. Either those who are in power completely dismiss the struggle, or they try to make some concession. By making concession, they may increase their legitimacy, but that's not part of our government. And NHRC, if we are able to make it really function effectively, because we have APCLC has sent the largest number of pigeons to NHRC, and we have a full knowledge of how the NHRC functions. Its statute itself is very unsatisfactory, and the man who has been put in charge is even more unsatisfactory, and the way he is functioning is even worse. Raman Mishra is the last person who could have been chosen. Krishna is still alive and Bhagavati is still alive. These are people who sat in the court and gave some strong judgments in favor of civil liberties. Raman Mishra never gave. But this man has been made chairman. Evidently, P.V. Narasimha knows whom to keep where. He knows all. And then in their functioning, the only power NHRC has is to merely inquire into atrocities and prepare reports. They are not given that. They are merely holding workshops and seminars. Still, we can hold them to task. We can force them to come. I mean, we ran after them, went after them, forced them to have an inquiry on encounters in Andhra Pradesh. It had a very salutary effect on both the public and the police in it. For the first time, people could come out and openly talk about such and such police officer picked up my husband and shot him down. It was televised. It came in the papers. It has given some confidence to the people. And some amount of fear to the police that these fellows have come this far, this time, next time they will put me in jail. Some amount of fear. That is the reason why we should demand this institutional change. That the granting of the institutional change will give legitimacy to the state. That will not be an argument if you are able to show that these institutions are inadequate. He has given this institution which is some kind of a patchwork. If that can be exposed, that legitimacy will go, and then he will be forced to give a better institution. Until he gives the perfect institution, afterwards we don't mind if it gets credibility. It doesn't matter. Until then, we can go on exploring. So, I think this kind of a struggle for the immediate needs for livelihood, for protection of the rights of livelihood, for improving democratic rights, improving equality of opportunity. This is that there has been a overall marginalization of industry, of the working class, a casualization of labor. I think that's coming up very sharply all over the country. That's true. But there's no contradiction between these two. Especially when we are talking of reservations. It's not the manual working class, because manual working class is largely anyway scheduled caste, backward caste, and so on. It's especially the relatively better off jobs industry which are completely cornered by the market. And there, without reservation, people from scheduled caste or many backward caste will not be able to. As far as manual labor is concerned, they are the only ones who labor along with the poor among the upper caste, and they will get jobs anyway. That's it. So these are separate problems which can be taken up and they cannot be joined. There's no reason for us to regard the one as being opposed to the one. His question is, that we have understood my statement as saying that Dalits are women and women are in opposition to each other, are being opposed to each other. What I have said to say is that the rights of women, the question of oppression on women, is being used to deny the rights of Dalits or to justify the oppression of Dalits. It's that separate, being used by somebody else. It's not being that, not that women are opposed to that. It's that the upper caste men who control villages. When Dalits in the village speak out about untouchability or about atrocities, they are using their women as a tool. And using the sympathy that women get or a sympathy that is generated in society whenever atrocities take place on women, that is being used to deny the rights of Dalits and to justify the suppression of them. That's the point I'm trying to make. I'm not saying that they are opposed to each other. Exactly what you are saying is happening. That is, if anybody says that a woman has been raped, it creates a certain idea in society, a certain aversion to the fellow who has done it, a certain reluctance to take up his, talk about his rights. And then he becomes a condemned fellow. That is the simplest way of condemning someone in villages, having done injustice to him, having subjected him to injustice. You say that he has come and tried to molest my daughter. That is another one. That's why I said in Chundur, they deliberately use a Brahmin woman because it becomes much more in our social culture. It becomes much more severe if a Brahmin woman has been raped rather than any other. That was also used very deliberately. And as I said, we could easily expose the colony. He was asking about the misuse of the SCST Atrocity Act. In our experience, it is being misused in this way. It's not that there may be cases where Dalits have deliberately fostered false cases on upper caste people for political. There are cases, I'm sure they are there. But more than that, what is happening is in a village where there is a conflict between, let us say, a TDP landlord and a Congress landlord. In order to harass the other fellow, he uses Dalits. If he happens to have some Dalits who are in his group, he files a case against that fellow under the PCR Act or SCST Atrocities Act. That's happening much more frequently. That's a political misuse of power and brokers in the village. It happens very common. And there what happens, two things happen. One is Dalits become a tool in this struggle. Second thing is that a very useful act gets delegitimized, it gets condemned. So in society it spreads very fast that look, this act is being used for this. So the real purpose of that act goes into this. And if tomorrow the government says that this act has been extensively misused, we'll remove it. It creates a climate of opinion which will be in support. This is a very unfortunate part. So we have been able, I mean, wherever this happens, where we are in contact with local Dalits and especially Dalit organizations, we are telling them, you try to convince Dalits, they're not trying to convince Dalits not to be used like this. So long as you are used like this because he is your leader, ultimately it will be for your disadvantage because the act may be removed one day saying that it has been misused very much. They misuse it, then they'll remove it someday. So we should try to tell Dalits who happen to be in Congress party or Janata Dal, wherever, it may be any party they want to be, but don't get used by your leaders like for this problem. That's, I think, one has to educate them. You know, I think that is that issue that you have said is a very real one, and a movement has to be there because especially in professional colleges, engineering, medical colleges, they have this thing called ragging. It used to be a supposedly harmless thing. Now ragging has become also casteist. A boy who comes on reservations, when they do what's called ragging, they deliberately go on, and I have heard because I did my PhD in Regional Engineering College, Warangal, which is almost equal to IIT, it is almost equal to IIT. Now the kind of thing they used to say, what is their caste? He will mention. I have a brother who got 80%, he couldn't get seat. You fellow, you got 60% and you got seat. These are the ragging starts. It is supposed to be a way of familiarizing youngsters and with the elders. But it starts as a caste system. It has become a horrible culture in college. That has to be fought. Yeah, and the earlier point you made about reservations in research institutions is, I think, a very important thing because especially research institutions are today the preserve of Brahmin. Even other upper castes have not really entered. Somebody was joking that the Indian Institute of Science is called Iyengar Institute of Science. It is supposed to be one of the premier institutes for engineering, physics and mathematics, as if Brahmins alone are capable of it. So that is, I think, very important. But there is no contradiction between these. These can all be part of our demands, and depending on our strength, we can build movements and all this. And it's not something that only, as our friend said, it's not something only the civil rights movement did. Every political party, every organization has to do. I don't think even Ambedkar gave any single formula for annihilating caste. Yeah, 100 things have to be done if caste is to be annihilated. That's right. But even otherwise, is it possible to give a single formula which will annihilate caste? I don't think. One can say that if there is 100% intercaste marriage, caste will go. But then how will 100% intercaste marriage will be there? Then you have to ask the next question. Then the next question. You will have 100 things you have to do. What is it? After all, what is happening in the country in the last 10 years is a major effort at annihilation of caste. It takes the form of a variety of things, and we may have a lot of dissatisfaction about what this party is doing, that party is doing, that BJP's help has been taken by Bahujan Samaj Party and so on. We are all unhappy about this. But especially from 1980 onwards, after the debate of Mandal Commission has come forward, a number of political situations have come up which are part of the annihilation of caste. However unsatisfactory we may find the individual behavior of some political leaders, some political parties and so on. today, after all, unless specifically the caste issue had, if the caste issue had not been brought forward in Uttar Pradesh and Bihar by these parties, Janata Dal, Samajwadi Party, BSP and so on, today BJP would be ruling India. Nobody would have been able to stop BJP in Uttar Pradesh and Bihar without this single point program that BJP's interests are upper caste interests and they are not our interests for BCC. So today, otherwise 5 years ago BJP would have come to power in India. And BJP coming to, it may come to power tomorrow also, we don't still know the reason. That will be a major problem, not merely for Muslims. It will be a consolidation of Hindutva. And that will be bad for Dalits, it will be bad for working class, bad for women. Because the whole Hindu philosophical outlook is thoroughly anti-democratic. Because the whole point of view is that be satisfied with where you are born. That applies to women, it applies to Dalits, it applies to workers, it applies to everyone. Don't try to become equal. That is the essence of Hindutva. Whereas to try to become equal is the essence of democracy, the right to become equal. People who are working in India, it doesn't matter who is the employer. It's a question of our livelihood and we should ask for equal opportunity everywhere. I think it will be a very good thing, especially apart from if we can achieve, very fine. If we cannot achieve, the argument why it cannot be given, that argument will be in terms of the logic of international capital today. Freedom for capital and no social welfare is today's international ruling ideology. And that is one of the point, reasons why we are all opposing it. So that will come much more openly to the fore. That will be a very good thing for fighting even this multinational dollar. It depends on who comes into the movement, how they want to fight. The civil rights movement has always concentrated on creating an idea, trying to spread it, getting it entered into people's minds, giving them self-confidence that this is the right thing to fight for. And to try to create some institutions, some law, some statutory system. Beyond that, if people take over, different political forms are available. It's a very challenging and very good. The government has the statutory power to take steps about multinationals also. They will oppose it. They will say we withdraw capital. That will be a very good struggle. No? But whenever we talk about social welfare, those fellows are trying to withdraw capital. So why do you want their capital in our country? Can be part of the biggest struggle.